Hello, and welcome to this episode of The Complete Interpreter, the podcast by me, Sophie Llewellyn-Smith. You may also know me as The Interpreting Coach. Why The Complete Interpreter? Because you are more than an interpreting or translation machine. And that's why I try and bring you some 360-degree CPD, holistic CPD. I talk about interpreting skills, I talk about use of language, I failed to talk about marketing, and I often talk about mindset, and that is what I am going to talk about today. Partly because I keep seeing articles popping up on my social media feeds and elsewhere talking about a particular phenomenon, which is the one I'm going to discuss today, and that is habituation. Habituation is something that I often talk about when I'm giving sessions about stress management or exam nerves, and you will soon understand why. Habituation is a term that was first used in this psychological context in the 1970s, and it describes a reduction in a person's physiological responses elicited by exposure to a repeated stressor. What does that mean? It means that if you keep being exposed to the same source of stress, then eventually your body's reaction is attenuated. We're talking here about the neuroendocrine response, in other words, what happens in your brain and what happens with your hormones, the cardiovascular response, for example, the increased heart rate and increased blood pressure that you would expect if you're having a stress reaction to a stressful stimulus, and your emotional response as well. Now, the exact dynamics are obscure, so we don't really understand how exactly this attenuation takes place. But the general principle is that if you are repeatedly exposed to the same stressor, if that helps you understand the spelling, then you won't react so strongly to it. And in effect, you will feel less stressed because your heart rate won't be racing so much, you won't be breathing so hard, and whatever other signs of stress you are experiencing, you won't be releasing so much adrenaline and cortisol in particular. Interestingly, and I did not know this until I researched today's podcast, the habituation effect occurs in about 2/3 of people, or to be clearer, in certain experiments, the habituation effect occurred in 2/3 of people, and the other 1/3 of people just never habituated to the stressor. So this is something, if we can try and extrapolate from those studies, this is something that will work for some people or happen in some people and not in others. But I would imagine that most of you have experienced the situation where, let's say, you're sitting at home and suddenly you can hear banging noises from overhead or next door because your neighbours are having some building work done or something like that. And when you first hear the noise, it's really disruptive, it's really annoying. And then when you've been hearing the same noise for a little while or several hours, then you simply don't register it quite so much. Another really, really obvious example is people who live under the flight path of aircraft because there's an airport nearby. And they simply don't register the noise of the aeroplanes anymore after a while. Now, research has shown that you will habituate more quickly to a particular stressor or stimulus under certain conditions. First of all, if the particular stimulus doesn't change too much, so there has to be some kind of regularity to it. Otherwise, you don't habituate. If, for example, you're hearing a sound and that sound is loud, then soft, then different, you're not going to habituate to it. You also need a sufficiently long duration for the habituation effect to kick in. For example, if you hear a dog barking for 10 seconds and then there's a long break and then the dog barks again after 5 minutes, you're going to notice it just as much the second time as you did the first time round. You need sufficient frequency of the stimulus for habituation to occur. And the intensity of the stimulus is relevant as well, because there are some very intense stimuli that you never habituate to. For example, the noise of a siren a police siren or an ambulance siren or something like that, or perhaps the sound of fireworks. Those things are so sudden and so loud that we never habituate to them. Mind you, who knows, if you heard the same siren for an hour, would you be able to habituate to it and have less of a response? Perhaps. I think it's also due to the fact that those very intense stimuli tend to be short-lived. Now, what can we do with this phenomenon to help ourselves, to harness it in a useful way? Well, habituation is something that is used to treat conditions like PTSD, anxiety disorder, phobias, and obsessive-compulsive disorder. And in fact, I've even read that habituation is a technique that is being promoted now or talked about as a way of dealing with tinnitus. And I thought some of you might find that relevant because I do know several interpreters who suffer from tinnitus and who've had increasing problems since they started doing RSI, remote simultaneous interpreting. One of the approaches to tinnitus is to use cognitive behavioural therapy to try to manage those unpleasant symptoms, and they use an approach based on habituation. But as I said, it's used to as part of the treatment for all sorts of other conditions like PTSD and phobias, and the way that that happens in treating phobias is generally through progressive exposure therapy. So let's say, for example, that you're afraid of the dark. You would begin by imagining a dark room. You're not actually in that room, you're nowhere near a dark room, you're not in the dark, but you maybe close your eyes and you start imagining a dark room. And gradually, when you get used to that and you're able to cope with the degree of stimulation, the degree of stress that you feel, the degree of fear, let's call it that, then you move on to another step that takes you a little bit closer to the real situation of being in a dark room. For example, you might stand just inside the door in a dark room, so there's still some light coming in from outside, but you're just inside the door, which means it's not fully dark, and you could also step out at any time. And when you're able to cope with that degree of stress slash fear, anxiety, then you would take another step and move closer towards the goal of being in a fully dark room. That's how exposure therapy is done, and it works for a number of reasons, people think. First of all, because people accept a new and more realistic beliefs about their fears. For example, the fact that if they experience that fear, they're not going to die. It's not the end of the world. They can, in fact, manage those sensations in their body and in their mind for a certain amount of time. So they accept new and more realistic beliefs about their fears. They can build confidence and self-efficacy when they realize that they can control their fears and cope with those fears. And thirdly, the habituation effect. By repeatedly being exposed to the thing that you're afraid of, a spider or a dark room or whatever, your physiological response is less acute. It's less intense. Now, I did say I was going to talk about how we can harness the habituation effect as interpreters, and I'm going to talk particularly about exams, but really the same principles or similar principles apply to your interpreting work. If, for example, you find certain meetings particularly stressful. One really good example of the habituation effect, actually, was something that I encountered recently when I was in Brussels running a stress management workshop for NATO interpreters, which was a really great experience over a period of a couple of days. And I had asked them beforehand what their major sources of stress were. And honestly, I expected them to say, the fact that we have to do these really high-level meetings about world-changing events, about the war in Ukraine, and also there's a lot of technical vocabulary, and it's incredibly stressful. I think there I was probably projecting my own feelings from when I used to do meetings I found extremely stressful, such as European councils or councils of ministers or meetings on subjects where I felt very uncomfortable, but they were quite high level. For example, one of the most stressful meetings I've ever done, I think, was a meeting of high level religious representatives. And so it was full of archbishops and chief rabbis. And it's not really a topic that I feel super comfortable talking about. I don't know my biblical quotes very well. And I found that incredibly stressful. But coming back to our muttons, the NATO interpreters did not say, oh, we're so stressed because of our work. On the contrary, most of what they talked about was not work related. And I could only conclude, and in fact, some of them said explicitly, I've been in this job for 10 years, and so I'm used to that. I know how to manage my stress. So either they felt less stress because of habituation, or they were implementing strategies to deal with that stress. And that is something that I found very interesting. But part of the point of habituation is that building confidence to deal with situations that you find stressful partly comes from doing. Confidence comes from doing. And this is something I see a lot with my daughter, for example, who is a perfectionist type and she lacks confidence. She will say that she's bad at certain things. For example, she'll say, I'm really bad at cooking. To which my answer is, you need to practice more. Just do more cooking. And then you'll get used to it, you'll master the techniques, and you'll find it less intimidating. So confidence largely comes from doing. It's hard to persuade yourself to be confident, or that you are confident, or that you will not experience stress in certain situations. Mind you, you can certainly reframe that stress. And if you want to hear more of that, do please listen to my podcast episode about reframing stress. It's not so much that you can prevent the stress response from occurring. It's more that you can learn to interpret that stress response differently. So if you have a racing heart and you're breathing quickly and you have a stomach ache or whatever the symptoms are for you, you can learn to reframe that as something akin to excitement, that something exciting is happening and your body is readying itself to deal with that challenge. And therefore, that is not an opportunity to fail. It's just an opportunity to show off your skills and do what you have learned to do. And so you can certainly attenuate the stress a little bit or interpret it differently through a mental exercise. But confidence also comes from doing something over and over, and that is partly due to the habituation effect. So when it comes to dealing with work stress or exam stress, some of the things that you can do to harness the power of habituation are attending practice groups, for example. If you find interpreting at certain meetings stressful, then put yourself in as similar a situation as possible. For example, sign up to a practice group where you don't know the members and you will have to interpret in front of strangers for the first time. A lot of members of my Rock Your Retour group for English Retourists tell me when they come to their first or second meeting that they were really stressed. They'll interpret and I'll say, how was that for you? How did you find it? And they'll go, I was really nervous, or I was really stressed. More so than in their normal work. Why? Because they're not used to interpreting in that situation. They're not used to interpreting in front of me and in front of a group of strangers. So put yourself in those situations, which mimic some of the stressful effects of, let's say, a high-level meeting or a meeting on a topic you're not used to or a meeting for clients that you don't know, but they are lower stakes than the real thing, because if you make a mistake or you don't interpret as well as you would like to in a practice group, it's not the end of the world. Another thing that you could do is join a debating society, for example, or any kind of club or association where there's a public speaking role in front of strangers, people that you don't know. And when it comes to exams, well, habituation is precisely the reason why universities organise mock exams. And indeed, why, if you have applied for something like the EU interinstitutional test, they also set the system up in such a way that you can practice with the platform and you can have a go with some speeches before the actual test. Now, I hope you can see that there is a very good reason for that, which is backed by research and which is to do with your body's responses that will actually be attenuated if you go to a mock exam or a mock session. So do make use of those, or try and create a similar situation if you have an exam coming up. And by the way, for all these reasons, it seems to me that if you're preparing for a UN test or an EU accreditation test, it's not actually a good thing to only practice by yourself. I think there's a really good argument for practicing in groups with people that you don't know very well. Now, I could leave it at that, but I didn't want to finish this podcast episode without talking about dishabituation. And this is what's coming up a lot in my social media feeds and news feeds, dishabituation, because I think a bit of extra research has been done on it recently, and so it's making the news. Why are people talking about dishabituation? Well, because the habituation effect can have implications on our daily lives that are not always desirable. For example, we become complacent about our relationships, or we live in a beautiful part of the world, but we don't even really notice it anymore. And that is because of the habituation effect. So one of the things that you can try and do is be deliberate about looking around you or about some of your experiences in life and try to consciously think about what is beautiful or amazing or striking about those experiences so that you can re-experience your mundane everyday routine with new eyes. Or try and introduce a bit of novelty into your typical routines. I don't know about you, but I'm someone who thrives on routine, and I find it very difficult when my day or week is chaotic and when I don't know what to expect. So by default, I try to organize my time so that there is a predictability to it and so that I do certain things certain ways. And generally speaking, that serves me very well. But the downside is this habituation effect, that then you cease to have novelty in your life, and that it sort of dampens your enjoyment. I want to give you a few examples from research which I found really interesting. One study was carried out on people who were having dinner in a lovely restaurant, and they were asked, do you think you will enjoy it more if you stay sitting in this nice part of the restaurant with delicious food and a beautiful view, or do you think you'll enjoy it more if every so often you go to the back of the restaurant where it's really noisy and it's near the toilet, so there are people walking past all the time? And perhaps not surprisingly, most people said, well, no, obviously I'm going to have a much nicer time if I stay sitting in my comfortable seat with a beautiful view and with the nice and attentive waiters. But actually, in reality, when they looked at people's enjoyment, it was people who had a contrast in their experience who enjoyed it more at the end of the day. What does that suggest? If you're going to a lovely restaurant, perhaps it suggests that you should stand up once or twice and go to the loo or go to the bar to order another drink, because it's then coming back to your wonderful table with the company that you're keeping and the view that makes you appreciate it all over again. I'll give you another example. People who were having a massage. The question was, did they enjoy it more if they had the massage all in one go, or if it was broken up several times? And again, maybe not surprisingly, people said, well, I would far rather have my massage all in one go so that I can get in the zone. But no, in reality, it was the people whose massage was broken up into several parts that enjoyed it more. And that is the process of dishabituation, that you have your 10 minutes of massage and then it stops for whatever reason. You get up and have a drink, or who knows how you manufacture a reason to stop. And then you start again and you enjoy it all over again. And part of what's happening there is that we enjoy things more at the beginning. It's the firsts that we enjoy more. And so there's been some research on people going away on holiday and their enjoyment of the holiday. And again and again in the questionnaires, they talked about the first swim I had, the first cocktail I had, when I first saw our accommodation. Those were the things that really marked people. And the people who ran this study looked at peak enjoyment, as it were, on a holiday, and they found that people's peak enjoyment came 43 hours after the beginning of the holiday. And after that, it was downhill from there because they got used to it. They got used to their beautiful villa, the sea view, the type of food that they were eating. They got used to lying next to the pool every day, reading their Kindle or whatever it was. And I'm sure you have had this experience that when you come back from a holiday, it really doesn't take long at all before you feel as if you never left. It doesn't even take a week before you're back into the daily grind and you feel as if you had never been away. The advice that we get from psychotherapists on this and researchers is, I don't know, pretty obvious to me, but maybe we don't do it enough. And their advice is, in order to maximize your enjoyment, you should spread your holidays out across the year. So instead of going on one big trip, go on several small trips. And then you have this novelty effect, but also you have the joy of anticipation several times throughout the year. So you squeeze more juice out of the whole experience. And maybe it's not just with holidays that we should implement this practice, but we should also try to introduce novelty in our lives simply as a way of experiencing more joy. Try and do something new every week. Have some new experiences. Try a new activity. Go out with new people. I was thinking about this business of spreading out your holidays and having shorter breaks but more frequently. My ideal thing would be to have longer breaks more frequently, but okay, there are limits on that, to do with money, school holidays, the number of days leave that my husband has. That would definitely be my ideal situation. But I was trying to think about the kinds of holidays that we have nowadays compared to the kinds of holidays I had when I was younger. I can remember holidays in Greece when I essentially did the same thing every day. I went to the same beach. I lay on the same beach. I read the same book until it was finished. I ate very similar food. I loved those holidays. But now I tend to do something different. And if I go somewhere new, in that new place, I will be looking to do something different every day. Maybe go on a different hike or go and visit a particular site in the country or a museum if I'm in town. Just try and do different things, because then the novelty and the enjoyment are present every single day and it's continuously exciting. I will finish with upsetting experiences. Is it better to get upsetting experiences over with in one go, or is it better to break it up? When people were asked if it was better to break up unpleasant chores, for example, cleaning the toilets, or unpleasant experiences like having to listen to banging noises from the neighbours building work while you're trying to do your own work, the majority of people said it's better to break it up because they felt that they would be fortified by the break and then they could go back to it and it would be less awful. But no, in reality, it turned out that it was better to do it in one go because you have the habituation effect. So the awfulness of cleaning the toilets or listening to the banging noise or whatever it is diminishes gradually over time, instead of you're having that same feeling of doom and that sinking feeling when something horrible begins three or four times because you've broken it up into three or four bits. So when it comes to upsetting or annoying experiences, the old adage that you should rip off the band-aid seems to be correct. I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts on any of this. Do email me at info@theinterpretingcoach.com and let me know if you try and do horrible, annoying, upsetting things in one go, or if you try and break it up, whether you spread out your holidays across the year to have more joy, and whether you deliberately expose yourself to stressful situations in an effort to experience them and perceive them as less stressful on subsequent occasions. Do please check out the show notes, where you will find a link to a very short form where you can tell me what you'd like me to talk about next. Hope you enjoyed this one. Speak to you soon.